Okay. VTF, this is TechNet number 1522 of the series that began in September of 1982. You guys know, you guys have heard the preamble so many times, you know the story. Why we gather, how we do it, and so on. Whether or not it's going to be an interesting TechNet or a boring one is a function of you guys and what questions you ask. Let me drop. A little bit later on, if there's a gap, I have a story I can tell you about a tower incident that I ran into a couple of weeks ago. You guys also, a significant number of you probably went to the Maker Faire, and I'm going to be asking you later on what you saw. Did you like it? Was it worth it? Going back next year? What did you see and how good it was? Oh, by the way, did you see any 3D, three-dimensional printers? That's a joke, because I have already heard one report that there were quite a few of those there. At this time, we take check-ins from the TechNet, for the TechNet. You're going to give me your call letters, your name, and the word yes, which means you do have a question or a comment. You need not check in simply because you're listening. After 32 years and 1,522 TechNets, we believe somebody is listening. That doesn't have to be proven anymore. And by the way, that many TechNets, that many years under one leadership, quite possibly is a record. I'll have to find that one out someday. The first hour, as you guys know, is going to be questions and answers, followed by the mailbag with KC2WGB, followed by the space report from our space expert, Paul, WS2N. And along the lines, we'll be listening to K6DPZ, who will give us some more brief answers based on his experience. So give me your call letters and name right now if you do have a question or a comment for the TechNet, K2LIW.
KD2, FQU Mobile, yes, with questions.
And Mr. FQU, I should know your name, but please tell me.
Sorry about that, Dick. It's John Juliet Oscar November.
Okay, and your mobile, give me a quick response, John. Will you be within range for the next half hour, or should we go to you first to make sure you don't go out of range? Over to you, John.
Yes, I'll be within range.
You should have realized. Silly question. You are the first guy. You're going to be number one in the runway. All right. We got one check-in. Anyone else to check-in? Give me your call letters and name right now.
Into exchange after both.
We got John and Wes so far. Anyone else?
Eric 3, X-Ray, Hotel, Britain, in Toronto.
Okay, that voice is quite broken up. From Toronto, and I'm guessing that was XJN. It sounded like it didn't sound like DE3JIW. Not quite sure. Go ahead, Dan, if you happen to have those call letters, John, you're probably watching on Echo Link, so you know who it is. So go ahead, John, KC2WGB, tell me who it was.
Is my coming through Echo Link? All right. Nope, nobody on Echo Link. I thought it was Jim from Toronto.
Okay, that Jim would be VE3JIW. The man from Toronto, please give us your call this one more time. It did come through broken up.
I think there's a problem with the internet. We can jumble.
Okay, there was a long delay of nothing, and then you were saying that there seems to be a problem with the internet. And then you didn't repeat your call. So repeat your call a number of times. Toronto, K2RIW listening. IILP, Dick. Okay, it's an IRLP signal, and repeat it a few times.
Victor Echo 3, Victor Echo 3. Victor Echo 3. From.
Okay, once, three times in a row, I heard Victor Echo 3, blank, hotel, blank. And from that, I should be able to figure it out from my past check-in. Where in the world did I put those? I forgot to go back more than one page. Here we go. This is Victor Echo 3 X-Ray Sierra Hotel. Victor Echo 3 Zebra Tango Zebra and JIW. I'm going to guess it was Victor Echo 3 X-Ray Sierra Hotel, Julian. Am I right on that one?
Affirmative. Thank you.
barely broken up, but I did hear the affirmative, so apparently it's Julian. Alrighty. One last call. Anyone else to check into the technet? Give me a call with his name right now. K2LAW.
WS2N, Paul. And we're out here with a space report. Back to you, Dave.
Very fine, Paul. Okay, John, Kilo Delta 2, Foxtrot, Quebec Uniform, mobile. Go right ahead with your question, K2LAW. You got it, John.
Thank you very much, Dick. This is KD2FQ Mobile. My question for tonight is I'm new to being a ham radio operator, and I'm interested in Morse code. I recently purchased the MFJ 557 oscillator and practice straight cure. But I'm looking for a way to assist me with learning Morse code, so the CW, Koch method, and Farnsworth. And any opinion to which one will be easier on the user to understand it, grab it, and be proficient in it in a fair time frame.
I wish we still had Mel K2KEY with us. He became a silent key a couple of years ago. He's a guy who is so heavily wrapped into Morse code that he would play Morse code to a speaker under his pillow every night as he went to sleep. He listened to Morse code as he went to sleep each night because he found it so relaxing. So when it comes to the Farnsworth method or the Koch method or any other method for learning Morse code, you guys out there who have got any information along these lines, give us your call letters right now. K2LAW.
K2UPS.
Okay. Here's a CW man from way back. Hey, Richard, K2UPS, mobile. I'm going to guess he's in West Virginia, Ohio, Pennsylvania. He's way out there somewhere. K2UPS, tell us whatever you know on this subject, Rich. K2LAW.
Hey, good evening, Dick. It's K2UPS Mobile. I'm in Ohio right now, almost into West Virginia, heading back to New York. And good evening to John. It was nice meeting you the other night. I would recommend using both Koch and Farnsworth method. And if you have a PC or a Windows-based computer, look up G4FON. That's Golf 4 Fox Ocean Nancy. He has a free CW program that is excellent. It is highly customizable. It uses the Koch and Farnsworth method, and you go at your own pace. You know, you set the thing up. The Koch method, it starts with just two letters, but they're sent at you at a very high, you know, at like 20 words a minute, so you learn to hear the sound of the letter and not count the dits and the dials. You don't want to fall into that trap. And then you slowly reduce the space between the letters using the Farnsworth method, and before you know it, you'll be doing 20 words a minute. But look up that program. If you have an Android phone, there's also some really good apps out there for your cell phone that'll assist you with that too. But that would be two places I would say to start. Dick, back to you.
Oh, glad you checked in tonight, Rich. Oh, glad that John knew you were there, because with the delay system, we wouldn't have known it ordinarily. Sounds like you have used those three techniques, Farnsworth, Koch, K4, Fox, Oscar, November. Sounds like you're very happy with it. I remember visiting you and listening to some of the Morse code you were sending. Just to give us a little bit of a familiarity with you on this particular subject, Rich, you've been doing Morse code for roughly how many years? And make a rough guess. What is your Morse code speed? And I'm pretty sure the highest speed is going to be purely mental, because one of the things I did on a couple of practices is when I'm writing down the alphabet and I know exactly what letter is coming, I can just barely write at 22 words a minute. So under normal circumstances, I think anybody beyond 20 words a minute, unless he's real good at shorthand, has to do it either mentally or with a typewriter. So what's your length of time with Morse code, and how often do you use it, and what do you believe your Morse code speed is now, Rich? K2UPS in Ohio, going for West Virginia, I think it is. Oh, yeah, Ohio, about to go to West Virginia. K2RIW, you got it, Rich.
Okay, well, I've been licensed since about 1982. Haven't been active the whole time. There was about a 10-year period in the middle there where I was inactive. But I was into CW as soon as I got licensed. Even as a novice, I just took it to it and really enjoyed it. Right now, if I'm having a QSO with somebody, depending on how tired I am, between 15 to 20 words a minute just in casual QSOs. If I get into a contest situation or a field-based situation, then I'm up about 30 words a minute. But that's just call signs and exchange, so it's rapid fire. You know what to expect pretty much. But it's great. I thought when they went to the no-code license that was going to be a very bad thing, but I've been pleasantly surprised. There is really still a strong interest in CW, and now that people don't have to learn it, they're like, well, maybe I should learn it. And we teach a lot of classes every couple of months and then get more people onto CW portions of the band. And it's a very, very fun mode, especially if you're into QRP operating like I am. As it, CW will get through when the voice doesn't. Back to you, Dick.
Well done, Rich. Fantastic. it's pleasant to find that when it's no longer required, it's not forbidden fruit, so to speak, or whatever, people will go to it. It is a very interesting art form. And for those who do learn it, many of them really think they're going to hate it, and a significant percentage find out that they love it. Of all the contest operating I did on the 10,000 meg handband, 10.368, where during the contest of August and September, the 10 gig and above contest, most code is used about 60% of all the QSOs, never 40% of sideband. It's hard to believe that on a frequency that high, way up at 10,000 megs, people use Morse code, and without a doubt, it's got the greatest sensitivity. There's one slight exception to that. Let me drop. During the 4.5 years that I held QSOs with K4CAW in Greensboro, North Carolina, he's 200 miles inland in North Carolina, 480.0 miles airline distance from me. And although I've got 100 feet of tower and 300 feet of land on Long Island, and in that direction I look out over the Atlantic Ocean for half the distance, and then the rest of it's inland, you would think that Morse code and sideband would have a significant difference over that particular path because of the way the radio horizon was 40 miles and he's 480 miles away. He's more than 10 or 11 or 12 times beyond my radio horizon. So the signal is getting there by way of forward propagated tropospheric scatter. It's getting there by way of atmospheric inhomogeneity, in other words, little bubbles of air rising from the land somewhere where the sun is shining on a freshly plowed piece of dirt, and therefore you're getting a thermal, and the thermal of hot air has a slightly different density than all the air around it that it's rising through. Let me drop. Therefore, a very long range over the horizon signal on 10 gigs, for instance, hits that pocket of warm air, which has a slightly different density, and it gets scattered. And it gets scattered over the horizon. So there's a whole bunch of pockets of warm air, moist air, dry air, raining air, snowing air, whatever, for 4.5 years. Every Tuesday night from 7:30 to 8 o'clock, he and I just couldn't believe a signal would go that far. When you're running a kilowatt on each end and a lot of antennas on each end, we both had 100 feet of tower. I was running 16 Yagis, and he was running 4 very long Yagis. And so we were getting through 90% copy summer, winter, spring, and fall. Under that kind of condition, where there's all kinds of flutter to the signal, under that particular condition, when we compared Morse code to sideband, the copy was approximately the same. Because of the way the signal was fluttering in and out in amplitude, with Morse code, you would drop certain portions of it. And same thing with a single sideband voice, you're dropping certain syllables. But because of the redundancy of human speech, you were able to put the message back together equally well with sideband versus CW. So that was the one exception I can remember. Almost all other situations, Morse code is always a flower and above. So it's a very good art form to concentrate on. You're going to enjoy it. There are people who can copy Morse code at numbers like 60 words a minute. When you listen to 60 words a minute Morse code, let me drop. sent by a machine, so to speak, or a man acting like a machine with an automatic ear. It's a blur. How in the world can a human mind act that fast? And one of the exciting things you find out about Morse code, for many people, somewhere in the vicinity of 8 or so words a minute, they call it the hump. In other words, as you're studying Morse code and you're practicing correctly and you're keeping track of your speed, you notice that during the practice session, your speed doesn't increase. You come back the next morning and test yourself again, you realize that overnight, the brain has done something, worked on the problem, and all of a sudden your code speed increased. But somewhere around 8 or 9 words a minute, you hit that particular wall, and for a couple of days on end, it looks like you're making no progress. And all of a sudden, you hear a sound, your hand moves, it writes down a letter, and you say to yourself, who did that? All of a sudden, the brain has short-circuited a number of the steps, and so the sound becomes a motion of the hand almost unconsciously. It's a weird phenomenon that you hear at around 8 or so words a minute. Another thing I've noticed is that somebody could be sending Morse code in the middle of a movie, and before I realize it, quite a few of the letters go by, and I didn't catch any of it. I have to switch the brain portion on, saying, hey, that's Morse code. Let's pay attention to that. Let's switch on that portion of the brain. All of a sudden, I can copy it. But when I didn't know it's coming, and I can't remember the particular sound, I don't get it at first. It appears to be a certain section of the brain dedicated to that function, and you have to say, I want to turn on that subroutine right now. I bet you're going to recognize some of these things as you go through the process, John. Kilo Delta 2, Foxtrot Quebec Uniform, Mobile, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Thank you, K2RIW. This is KD2FTU Mobile. As K2UPS mentioned, there's some apps available. I did get an app for the Android phone from IZ or India Zeta to Uniform Foxtrot that has both the G4 FON, Foxtrot Oscar Nancy, and another method with Farnsworth and the Koch in it. And what it does is it plays the sound, the dits and dahs. It'll say what the syllable is after about 2 or 3 seconds, and it'll go for approximately like 5 minutes if you can adjust it. Is there, let me just let it drop. In practicing a CW for any new ham radio operators, there a suggested time frame for fourth as 20 words per minute and spacing of the characters suggested for learning the CW?
To go through a learning process where you speed or slow up the spaces between the letters and the speed at which you send each letter, for some people there's an advantage, but you got to be careful on that one. Me and my buddy Rob K2RJB, I'm K2RIW, and my buddy K2RJB, unfortunately he dropped his license, Bob Nielsen, and I would practice Morse code with each other, and we had gotten into the habit of sending the letters fast and making the space between the letters long in order to get to the speed we needed, 13 words a minute. And we went before the FCC examiner. We were up to 15, 16 words a minute by our particular method. And in front of the FCC examiner, it was being sent by an automatic machine with clearly defined spacings and lengths of letters and whatever. By our standards, it sounded like it was all run together. They had, by our standards, decreased the spaces, increased the length of the letters, which is the opposite of what we wanted to do, which we had practiced. We both failed the test the first time. Had to come back a month later after practicing the right way. So when you hear really nil specification Morse code, so to speak, has a very specific cadence, very specific spacing. One other funny experience I'm going to tell you about, let me drop it. When you operate for many hours on end during a contest, a VHF contest or a 10 gig contest, you do it for many hours on end and you take a break. You suddenly realize you've been listening to weak signals in the noise for hours on end and your brain is still hearing weak signals in the noise, even though you're away from the rig. You go go to the bathroom, you flush the toilet, and while the toilet is making its tank-filling noises, you hear Morse code buried in that noise. You go to the kitchen, and the refrigerator is running, and the refrigerator is making a certain amount of noise, and you hear Morse code inside of the noise made by the refrigerator. Of course, this is phony, but you get this funny effect when you've been doing it for many hours. The brain creates Morse code in the noise that ain't really there. Let's see now, what was your last question? I hope I... Let's see, anybody want to contribute anything more to John about Morse code experience, methods of learning, and so on? Give me your call letters right now. K2LAW in the tech net.
US2N.
Paul recognized. Anyone else?
WA1SFH.
Okay, we heard WA1SFH. Very fine. In that order, we're going to go to Paul first and SFH. So, Paul, how long have you been using Morse code? What do you believe your Morse code speed is? Do you really enjoy it during contests? How did you learn? Tell us anything about all of your above, Paul. WS2N, the Morse code expert of Ronkonkoma, Long Island, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Okay, I think if you have a receiver of any type, you know, you could listen to W1AW. They're on, you know, Monday through Friday, not on the weekends. And they have slow code, and then all the way up to bash. You know, they'll do 10 words, 13, 15, 20, 25, and so on, even 30, 35. And they'll progress, you know, as they go. Or they'll actually go in reverse. And there's a chart for it, you know, you could actually look that up on the internet for the chart. But I used to like to listen to 80 meters and 40 meters, you know, for CW. That was, you know, it's kind of like, it's not really like the Farnsworth method, it's like what you were saying, Dick, but it's good to be able to give yourself a good idea of how fast you're going. Like slow code is 5, 7 and a half, 10 and 13 and 15. You hang out in that area and, but you know, I like 40 meters and 80 meters is great, you know. Especially 80, I 3.5815, and I have all the other frequencies here. But I don't know if he's got a receiver. All right, Dick, let me drop it. And naturally, you know, when we took our license, I had to get up to 20 words a minute. But for instance, the bulletins from W1AW are 18 words a minute, so I could do that on a regular basis. I miss some here and there, but. Yeah, again, that's not really the Farnsworth method. You probably go quicker just listening to, you know, in a QSO. But it gives you a good gauge. That's why I like doing that. Plus, the signals are just booming in from Connecticut, you know, on 80 and 40. And they have other frequencies, too. You know, the other bands are all covered by W1AW. Back to you, WS2N.
Glad to hear all of that, Paul. Yep, W1AW is a good way to know your exact speed, done in the exact way. By that I mean it's machine sent, so that it's perfect. It has no personality. With rare exception, every one of us who learns Morse code really has a special signature, just like the way you write your name, the way you write longhand a letter to somebody. There's a very specific handwriting characteristic which usually can be recognized. So most of your close friends, after you've talked to them a lot with Morse code, you hear them send four or five letters, and you say, oh yeah, that's John, I recognize him. They all have a particular swing, a particular method by which they send Morse code. So when you get really good at it, you can recognize that signature of almost everybody, except this one guy, W2KRM, George Flanagan, who was running Morse code classes at Airborne Instruments Laboratory at noontime every day for 3 or 4 years. Many of us went from our 13 words a minute up to 22 words a minute to get our extra class license, and 20 words a minute was required for the extra class license in the old days. And so George is the one guy I know who could send Morse code with no personality. It sounded like a machine. And he really considered that an art form and worked at it very hard. Let me drop... Doug's next on the list, WA1 Sierra Foxtrot Hotel in Milford. Now, in Milford, there is AHAM. Pete cycles and 2 meters. And I'm pretty sure he's still in Milford, still on those bands. And I bet you've run into him because you and he live in the same town as Doug. To be one SFH, K2RIW and TechNet. You've got a Doug.
Thank you and good evening. This is WA1SFH, and yes, Pete lives maybe a mile and a half from my house, so I know him quite well. When you get a chance, tell us about your experience at MeatFest.
But anyway, about Pete Webber, a couple of weeks ago, I was teaching boat stuff from Kimmel and Rob, Bob.
One more time. A couple of years ago, I was teaching the Boy Scout merit badge, and I taught them a very fat, about a 15 words per minute character, with so they read it out that way, and then we started putting words together with a bit of a gap, and then we'd narrow the gap between the letters. So when we did the ARRL code practice at 5 words a minute, and tuned in for that, we found we were late. So what they got to do, instead of passing 5 words a minute, they actually qualified at 7.5, and they were bored. The other thing I was saying was that I also appreciate what you said about hearing Phantom CW. It's an amazing phenomenon what the brain will do. And I also have the problem with movies. I'm too involved as a member of the audience watching the plot and what have you. And then CW comes along and says, "That's CW! Let me get out of this mode and see if I can copy CW." So it's a tough one, but you're right. Back to you, Dick. WA1SFH.
Very fine, Doug. All of that came through beautifully that time. And Eric is working on repairing the malady that's in the controller that sometimes allows it on long periods without a complete reset of the machine, where it suddenly goes into some kind of a sideband-like sounding mode. So it sounds like some of your experience is somewhat similar to mine. And I can see you're involved in quite a few emergency operations there in the Milford area. So Morse code is good. And you're going to be joining a fraternity of people who really love that portion, as I see it, John. KD2FQU for any other comments. K2RIW the TechNet.
Thank you very much, guys. It's a knowledge, it's a pool of knowledge just listening here. It's giving me a feel of what I can expect. I'm still questioning the, as I'm sorry, K2UPS did mention the G4FON program for the computer. I'm going to look into that when I get home. And my last question would be a suggestion maybe from any one of you guys. Listening to the code process, not just checking the dots and the distant dots, but listening to the verbal. Sorry, now let me let it drop. Listening to the verbal pronunciation
Just hearing the machine or the computer say exactly what that code is after a few seconds, would that be suggested for like 5, 10 minutes or 15 minutes out of the day or an hour maybe or a half hour? That's my last question.
Yeah, when we first learn Morse code, if we're not careful, we end up hearing dots and dashes. You got to be careful. You got to be hearing dits and dahs, if you know what I mean. Don't count dots and dashes. Second of all, in the beginning of learning Morse code, our tendency is to hear a code sound, write it down as fast as possible to clear your mind to get ready for the next letter. Good common sense. Answer is no. So make sure you're hearing dots and dashes, hearing dits and dahs. Make sure that you're not really counting dots, you're just recognizing what two dots, three dots, or four dots sounds like without necessarily counting them. But any of the people who are really good at Morse code reception will tell you that eventually they learn to do a lot of delay. The person is writing down letters, sometimes two, three, and maybe even four letters behind. In other words, you're allowing the sounds of the Morse code to go into the brain as if it's a pipeline. And along the pipeline, the brain is processing the Morse code. At the tail end of the pipeline, a portion of the brain is saying, okay, write down this letter. So don't be afraid to intentionally put in delay. It's also my belief, it's my belief that no matter what method you use, fast letters and big spaces, long letters and small spaces, it almost doesn't matter. No matter what you're going to do, you're going to have to listen to Morse code a certain number of days, weeks, or whatever before it gets burned into your brain and becomes a good process for you. So which exact method you use, I think, doesn't matter. When it comes to the amount of practice, my buddy Bob and I, we sometimes practice for 5 minutes a day, sometimes 10 minutes a day, sometimes an hour and a half a day. On the chances where we practice an hour and a half a day, and we looked at how much our speed increased during the day, it didn't. How much it increased over the 24 hours before we measured again the next day, it didn't matter. Whether we practiced for 10 minutes a day or an hour and 10 minutes a day, the amount of speed increase over the 24 hours seemed to be the same. The conclusion we came from all of that was practice a good solid 10 or 15 minutes a day. Don't bother going any longer. Let the brain process the stuff overnight, and the next day when you do a test, you'll find that your speed's a little bit faster. That's my particular experience. Maybe other guys out there have got a different experience. So I think the method you learn doesn't matter. The amount of time you practice per day is not very much of a difference, as long as you've done a 10 or 15 minutes worth, I think. And don't expect the speed to increase during the practice. It takes place overnight as the brain works on the problem. Anybody got any further comments? Give me a call that has a name right now. K2LIW in the TechNet. Looks like we've drained the available knowledge on this particular subject tonight, John. Please check back with us periodically and tell us how your experiment and your experience goes. But just keep at it. And if you have to skip a day or two because life gets complicated, don't let that worry you. But a little bit of practice every day, I think, is going to do magic. A number of my friends, at least two of them I can name, they thought that when they got to around 7 or 8 words a minute, no matter what they did, they're never going to get beyond that point. They were absolutely positive. And so because George, W2KRM, was running these code practice classes during the noon hour every single day at Airborne Instruments Laboratory, various people started listening to his machine sent Morse code. It was a real art form the way George did it. And all of a sudden, those people who were at a blockage at 8 words a minute for, you know, seemingly 2 or 3 weeks, all of a sudden had a breakthrough. So you may think, you can easily convince yourself that, hey, I've hit a wall, and no matter what I do, I can't go beyond that wall. Don't let yourself fall into that mode of thinking. There is no wall. There are people who continuously practice, and let me drop. In the beginning, the letter B, you'll hear a dash and the sound of three dots. Or the letter H, you'll hear four dots. You'll hear individual sections of a letter, and you'll be able to put it together as a letter. As you practice more and more, and you get this delay process, you allow yourself to write down the letter one, two, three, four letters behind the Morse code that's being sent to you. And don't get excited by the fact that you're delayed. You'll discover that, what's the point I was going to make here? Oh, yes. Pretty soon you realize you're hearing a sound, and you say, oh, I know what letter that is. Pretty soon you'll recognize groups of letters, T-H-E, and the word communication, C-O-M-M-U-N-N-I-C-A-T-I-O-N, the way the M-M and the U-U is in there, the duplications of the letters. All of a sudden you realize you're starting to hear not just letters, you're starting to hear letter groups, and eventually you're hearing words. And the guy that's at the 35 and 40 words a minute, he's starting to hear groups of words. He recognizes particular groups of words that are typically repeated in the English language. And he's starting to hear fragments of sentences and eventually sentences. So it's a funny way the brain works on this thing. So you'll be hearing sections of letters in the beginning, whole letters eventually, whole words eventually, sections of sentences, groups of words eventually is what you'll be hearing as you progress further and further. And the guys that are really doing it well, I think they're hearing almost complete sentences, if you know what I mean, before they write it down. I know a number of you guys went to the Meet Maker Fair that was held at the Hall of Science Center in East Meadow, is it? I can't think of the name of the town, but you know what, in Queens, where the World's Fair for 1964-65 was held. 63, 64, somewhere around there. The last World's Fair in Queens, Long Island, at that location, this Maker's Fair, and I think it was the fifth or sixth in the row Maker's Fair, and quite a few thousand people were there today. Some of you guys were there. Please give me your call letters and name, because I'm going to come back to you, and you're going to tell us what you saw, what you liked, what you didn't like. What was it like? Give me your call letters right now if you have any experience with the 2014 Maker's Fair in Queens that was Saturday and Sunday of this weekend. K2LIW listening. N2APG has a question. Okay, N2APG signed it. I just realized I skipped over Rip Julian. I shouldn't have done that. Let's hope that Julian's signal comes through a little bit better. Victor Echo 3, X-ray Sierra Hotel. Go right ahead, Julian. K2LIW in the tech net. I do know that Julian was having trouble getting his signal to come through with IRLP tonight. So we'll try him a little bit later. N2APG is the first guy who signed in with maybe some experience at Maker Faire. Let me give one more standby if anyone else went to Maker's Fair and wants to tell us what it was like. Give me a call with us right now. I know that Eric went. Hope he's going to tell us. So, Dave, did you go to Maker's Fair? Did you talk to the people who did? What's your impression? N2APG, the microwave voice of Massapequa, K2RIW. You got it, Dave. Yeah, hi, Dick. I don't have any info on the Maker Faire. I didn't attend that. And I also would love to hear, any people that have any info. In lieu of that, if there's nobody around, I do have a quick antenna question for you. I'm a little bit amazed that of the thousands and thousands of people, I'm not sure the exact number, but I'll bet you 10,000 or 15,000 people were there Saturday and some portion of Saturday and Sunday on the Maker's Faire. So it drew a lot of people. There was a parking lot some distance away. You had to pay $10 to park there. You had to take a commuter bus from the parking lot to the actual site because the site was apparently completely filled up. There was no local parking, so to speak. So it's a pretty big thing. But looks like the guys who went are tired and they're sleeping it off. And they're not willing to tell us this weekend. Maybe they'll tell us next weekend what they saw. Go ahead with your antenna question. Antennas are something I don't care anything about, Dave. They're useless. I don't know why anybody would want to study antennas. N2APG, that's a joke. K2LIW. Yeah, I agree with you. we should just take all antennas off the car to throw it out. I got a mag mount situation going on, and I haven't really had time to troubleshoot it too well. But it's one of those little, you've probably seen them, they call them the Hershey Kiss type mag mount antenna, with a little teeny magnet on the bottom that looks like a Hershey's Kiss. And I'm using it on a receiver only, not transmitting through it. The signals that I'm getting with that antenna as a mag mount on the car with the receiver are what I would say is about 50% strong as what they should be. And I suspect perhaps the, you know, the center conductor on the coaxial cable might be broken. Doesn't appear to be broken. It looks good. It's that little RG-174 coaxial cable. And what I noticed tonight when I am listening to a relatively strong signal on the receiver, when I lift the mag mount off the roof of the car, the signal goes away very quickly. And all I have to do is lift the mag mount just a little bit. I don't even have to totally take it off the roof of the car. It's enough to make the signal go bye-bye. So I was kind of wondering, what's your take on that? And if you can give me some basic troubleshooting techniques for that mag mount.
Well, that's correct in assuming that your Hershey's Kiss type mag mount is approximately 19 inches long if it doesn't have a loading coil. So it's not a multiple quarter wavelength. It's a 19 inch or shorter antenna. Is that roughly true, Dave, before I proceed?
Yes, it's 19 inches, no coil in it, and I am using it for, you know, VHF receiving, and I'm a little perplexed, and, you know, I have some basic troubleshooting the tools to use. I can use a continuity checker to check the continuity. I have an SWR meter I could put on there, and of course I could hook up a 2-meter handy talkie or a radio to it, you know, to do tests like that. So, go ahead.
Yeah, the first thing you want to know is that every reasonable antenna that doesn't contain an active amplifier or a circulator, one of these magnetic fancy devices, obeys the law of reciprocity. However it transmits, it receives with the exact same gain, the exact same pattern, the exact same standing wave ratio, the exact same side lobe amplitude, the exact same delay, the exact same a Q, and so on. Everything's the same. So whenever you're in doubt, transmit into it. Even though you only use it for receive, you're allowed to test it in the transmit mode, because that's going to tell you how well it's going to receive. In the transmit mode, what standing wave ratio do you experience? In the case of a quarter wave antenna, a quarter wave antenna is really half of a dipole. Every dipole is really a pair of quarter wave antennas back to back, hooked in series. And so there's a high current in the center and very low current at the tip. Because the high current in the center of a dipole becomes the high current bottom of a quarter wave mag mount, that magnet has to make extremely good capacitive coupling to its counterpoise. Let me drop. Its counterpoise is the rest of the sheet metal of the car. From its point of view, it is, your eye sees a quarter wavelength of antenna. Electronically, it is a half wave antenna. The other half is the mirror image inside of the sheet metal of your car, below your car. You've got a real quarter wave above, by way of the mirror image into that sheet metal. You've got another quarter wave below the sheet metal. Electronically, it's there. And so you need extremely good capacitive coupling from the bottom of that magnet to the sheet metal of the car. If the antenna was well designed for your size of sheet metal of car, and if you decided that, the piece of plastic in the bottom is worn through, and I'm going to change it to a thicker piece of plastic to make sure, and you therefore change the number of picofarad between the magnet base and the sheet metal of the car, it will change the tuning of the antenna. So as you can tell, that sheet metal is very important. Obvious by what you did when you pick up the mag mount and you bring it a quarter wavelength away from the sheet metal, a quarter of an inch away from the sheet metal, where the number of picofarads went down drastically, the capacitive reactants went up real fast,
electronically the antenna said, hey, that counterpoise, that ground plane, that sheet metal, it almost ain't there anymore. Therefore, you've got drastically different tuning. That antenna went from 146 megacycles resonance to probably 200 megacycles resonance when you brought it a quarter inch or a half inch off of the sheet metal of the car. The hand, let me drop. Your hand that's holding onto it, you'd like to believe your hand is a good ground. If the antenna was electronically a half wavelength long, where you're feeding it from the outer tip of a half wave dipole, where the impedance is something like 2,000 ohms, in that particular case, the capacitance of your body, which is around 100 picofarad, is a beautiful grounding. That's essentially what goes on with the NFED ZEP antenna. ZEP really means Zeppelin. In the case of a NFED Zeppelin antenna, which was literally designed for blimps back in the dark ages, the capacitance of the blimp to the universe was more than enough counterpoise, if and only if, the trailing wire out of the back end of the blimp was electronically half wavelength long, including the antenna tuner, in which case you're feeding a very high impedance, and the picofarad between the blimp and the rest of the universe acted as if it was the surface of the Earth, if you know what I mean. So a half wavelength antenna, very little ground plane, and your hand would do it. In the case of a quarter wave antenna, your hand is nowhere near the ground it needs. It really needs extremely good coupling to that sheet metal. So when you do a Vizwa test, and you do experiments of just changing the thickness, in other words, let me drop. An interesting experiment for you to do would be to put it onto the roof of the car in a normal manner, transmit it to it, and the amount of power that makes your standing wave ratio bridge work correctly, and measure the standing wave. And maybe you're going to see a 2-to-1 standing wave, which is not good, but at least it's not a showstopper. You're on the air. Then take a couple of sheets of newspaper or a couple of sheets of plastic or whatever and put it underneath your Hershey's drop antenna. Just increase the spacing between the base of the antenna and the sheet metal of the car. Guarantee you're going to see the Vizwar change real fast. So assuming the antenna hasn't suffered any kind of damage, in which case you measure the Vizwar and you're going to see 30 to 1. If the antenna is electronically working correctly, you're going to see less than 2 to 1. And then when you start experimenting with the thickness of plastic and size of the sheet metal and whatever, and where you mount it in the car, you'll eventually get the standing wave ratio down. So in the transmit mode, the standing wave ratio, you'd like it to be under 1.7 to 1 if you can get there, Dave, in which case it's got to give you full sensitivity. After that, whether or not you hear that repeater well is strictly a function of where is your car located and whether or not your particular automobile is now in some particular position in space where the reflection off the building plus the direct signal just happens to be in the null when you park the car. All of a sudden it's position sensitive, if you know what I mean. But your first requirement, of course, is the Vizwar of the antenna down, which really says, hey, it's resonating on 146 megs and it's ready to capture that signal. You have to resonate first before you can radiate. And the word radiate, I mean that both in the transmit mode and the receive mode. In either case, you got to resonate first before you can radiate. M28BG, K2RIW in the deck net.
Comment, Dick.
Yeah, stand by, Dave. Go ahead, John. And well, maybe you've got experience with that exact antenna. You got it, John.
KC2WGB. Yes, Dick, I found exactly what Dave was asking. I checked the continuity. It happened to have a PL259 connector on it. I checked the continuity, of course, from the center pin to the metal width that was on top. And as I wiggled the cable, I found the problem. So maybe something like that may be the issue. I don't know how new it is, but you might want to try something like that besides the what you're telling. Back to you, Dick.
Of the failure that you experienced, Sean, was the failure of the broken cable where you wiggled it and you made and broke contact. Was that failure near the PL259 male connector that went into the back of the rig? Or was it where the wire of the coax cable entered the magnetic base mount? Or sometimes in between? Where did you experience the failure, John? Go ahead.
Unfortunately, Dick, it was right at the bottom of the base where the whip made the connection. Just outside of the little candy kiss looking thing. That's exactly where the break, you know, and it was almost impossible to fix.
Now, I've had a couple of mag mount antennas that had that exact same failure. The because the chunk of cable that leaves the mag mount traverses across the roof of the car and eventually enters the door or window, depending on how you do it. That length of cable is flapping in the breeze and experiencing continuous mechanical flexing and therefore subject to failure. When I've had that failure happen quite a few times with me, I took things apart, chopped off the end of the cable, re-prepared the cable, plugged it back into the magnetic mount, and proceeded after that. I had to remount the cable, and luckily there was enough length of cable left for me to do that on a couple of occasions. One of the brand names of mag mount antennas I had, the cable itself had a center conductor, RG58-like cable, but the center conductor was a solid piece of wire, not a seven-strand thing. So it had very little flexibility, and therefore, without very much bending, it would experience metal fatigue, and the center conductor would break contact. Were you able to remount the cable in your case, John? KC2WGB, K2RIW?
Yes, Dick, it was a 74 cable, a 174 cable, which I don't know why they use that, because it has no ultraviolet protection. It should deteriorate pretty quickly. But yes, but the unfortunate, my mount had no access. I had to actually drill a hole in the bottom and remove the bottom so that I could get the cable to migrate in to make a new connection. That was sort of inconvenient.
Because you and I and many other people have experienced that failure right at that exact point, it really means we should put some kind of a grommet there which gives it mechanical support so that not all the bending takes place right at the place where the cable exits the metal housing of the mag mount. There's got to be some kind of support in that area if you really want a longer reliability of the thing. So when you test...
Quick fix?
Go ahead, what was the quick fix for you, John? How'd you know I'd hear you?
Oh, I know you listened to me, but basically what I did after the second time that it happened, and you're absolutely right, as you're driving around, you'll hear it flapping up there. Now, sometimes it's vibrating back and forth, and you don't hear it, but when it hits the roof, of course, you hear it. So that was the tip, and I said, okay, metal fatigue. What I did was I took a sticky back like you would use with a tie wrap. You peel off the thing and stick it. Well, you can't stick it to the roof, but what I did was I stuck a neodymium on there and then stuck that to the roof, and I kept the wire very steady.
Okay, a neodymium magnet. Okay, so you held it down to the roof with the neodymium magnet, the tie wrap, very crafty, so it no longer could move. So maybe the right combination is a grommet, and there's various ways you can create a phony grommet. You can create a phony grommet by squirting some celastic adhesive in the right spot, hoping it's thick enough to hold itself in the right position before it cures, and then stopping the rest of the cable from flapping with either something sticky or a neodymium magnet is certainly very sticky.
I got another
suggestion. Yeah, let's see. And as you find the troubleshooting and do these repairs, Dave, please come back and let us know what you found. In 2APG, K2RIW, in the TechNet.
Zen 2APG. Yeah, apropos to what John is mentioning, I've been using mag mounts for many, many years to eliminate that flapping of the cable on the roof. What I have done is taken some aluminum tape, metal aluminum tape, cut some little pieces of it, and literally taped the coaxial cable down to the roof of the vehicle so that the flapping is minimized, just about non-existent. You know, if you have to take the mag mount on and off every day, obviously that's not going to be a solution. But if you leave the mag mount on as a semi-permanent installation, I found that that aluminum tape does a very nice job, or stainless steel, you know, type tape that you can apply on the roof.
When it comes to dressing the cable, the coaxial cable coming from a mag mount on the roof of a car down into the innards of the car where it joins your rig, I used to do it directly. In other words, I would bring the cable directly from the roof over to where the door slams and then say, okay, the rubber seal around the door is going to go around the cable. Well, you always get a slow leak and you end up with water on the floor. The right way to do it, from my point of view, is to bring the cable into the channel, which is outside of the rubber grommet, but inside of the lip of the door. You bring the cable into that channel, tape it down with duct tape, green tape, whatever kind of tape you like, but now dress the cable so that it goes around the perimeter of the door, in my case, the rear perimeter of the door. Bring the cable down to the floorboard, so to speak, on the perimeter of the door, outside of the rubber grommet. Then you allow the cable to go across the rubber grommet, the rubber seal of the door. You allow it to go across there for the first time, down at the bottom. Now, any water that follows along your cable is going to be dripping away from the cable down at the bottom before it goes across the rubber seal. And then bring it into the car, underneath the carpet, and so on. So, if you want to not have water coming into your car, don't bring the cable in directly through the top of the door. Don't bring it in through the window. There's a whole bunch of disadvantages of that. Nobody can open that door anymore without disturbing your setup. And so, bringing it around the perimeter of the door and then bringing it across the rubber seal for the first time, down at the floor level, works for me very well. I'm a real enthusiast of bag mounts because no matter where you go, if you want to make it obvious that there's no radio in the car, to remove the mag mount is very easy. And to restore
repeater, time out.
To remove it is very easy. To restore it is very easy. And I like that. I don't have to drill any holes in the car. I don't have to do any permanent damage. I'm not affecting the resale value of the car. There are a number of people who believe, truly believe, that at the bottom of the antenna, doesn't go through the sheet metal and make direct contact to the sheet metal, screw to screw, metal to metal contact, that you're losing efficiency of the antenna. There's a tremendous number of people who believe that. It turns out the capacitive coupling that you get between the bottom of your mag mount, the plastic sheet, and then the rest of the sheet metal of the car, that capacitor is lossless. If you have any doubt, put 100 watts to that antenna, run a key down for 10 minutes, turn up the power and go over there and touch everything. If everything's working correctly, it's ice cold. You cannot waste power without heat. If each of the components of the antenna are running ice cold, and you're putting power into the antenna, and your standing wave ratio meter tells you the power is not being reflected back to the transmitter, it's going one day down the cable and never coming back, and everything at the antenna and all of the surrounding hardware runs ice cold, there is no choice. Every bit of that energy has been radiated, even though you've got what you think is a lossy coupling capacitor. That coupling capacitor cannot be lossy without it giving off heat. You'd be amazed how many people have a lot of trouble with that concept. Anybody have any further questions or comments on this material so far? Give me a call, let us right now. K2RIW and the TechNet. Okay, looks like we're right on schedule. Only 2 minutes late for the mailbag, John. And
the question before we go to the mailbag.
Give me your question, John.
Okay. I hope Al is listening or somebody who has a lot of experience in radios. I have a question about a receiver. It's an AM receiver. It's an SX99 Mark 1. It's made by Hallicrafter. It's an old tube rig. I'd like to know if anybody has any experience with that, or maybe you've seen it, Dick. Back to you, Dick.
Yeah, what is your question? Hallicrafter made a whole bunch of rigs. SX 90-something, 80-something, 99, 100, 103, 303, so on. There was a whole series of Hallicrafter's receivers. Many of them had two dials, a great big coarse dial on the left and a fine dial to the right. Many of them had a variable antenna tuning knob on the front panel, which is nothing more than a series capacitor between the radio and the input connector. They worked very well, tube radios. So what specifically would you like to know about that Hallicrafter, John? In fact, let me think now. Have I owned one of those? I've owned an HQ-129, 179, 189. I don't think I've owned a 99, but I've seen a lot of SX-100s. In the very beginning, the SX-100 was $330. Can you imagine, John? KC2WGB, K2RIW.
KC2WGB. Yeah, Dick, I was just wondering about the quality and what they thought of it. It also had a knob on the front that's labeled crystal tune.